understand geopolitics, you must have the freedom to be honest. The More Freedom Foundation podcast.
Hello, Rob. How are you this time?
Not bad, not bad. So what's your favorite AI catastrophe, Rory?
Oh, it's hard to know with catastrophes. I assume the obvious one would be is like it's basically ready to go, but it's just waiting for its moment to take over.
Mm.
So it could be ready. It could have the mental capacity, but it's just waiting for that moment, that one innocent person that gives it too much power, and then before we know it,
or
it's
maybe
all over.
Maybe it's already in charge and it's just subtly editing everything we consume.
That's very possible. So much, you know, so many podcasters have you met? Do the audience know we exist?
That's true.
I've only ever seen live the last podcast on the left. All the other podcasts could be fake.
Yeah, the More Freedom Foundation could be a 10-year op. I could not, in fact, exist. That would be that'd be quite something.
Because so much is consumed through computers and smartphones.
Well, I've always been partial to the Terminator movies.
Okay, classics.
One of my favorite things about the AI discussion in the United States is the way that it means everybody's referencing Skynet all the time.
Even though there is a Chinese company that is involved in facial recognition and AI called Skynet.
Amazing. Really?
Yes. But they said, we're like Skynet, but not evil, which is always a reassuring thing to hear.
For those of you who may not be aware, and shame on you if you're not, Skynet is the company from the 1980s, 1990s, well, I guess even into the
20s. Yeah, still going.
20s. Yeah, Terminator franchise is the company that creates Skynet, which becomes self-aware and decides to wipe out humanity and creates killer robots that look like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Very strong Austrians.
Yes, out of a it's a classic. If you haven't watched Terminator 2, you should. I saw that as a kid in the theaters, and I still adore it today. It's great fun. But there's another sort of AI catastrophe that I think isn't even necessarily posited as an AI catastrophe, but I think one that I've been thinking about a lot and sort of fits in well with our sort of Reagan versus AI worldview is Foundation. It's a book, a series of books by Isaac Asimov. It was recently turned into a television show that I'm not sure anybody actually watched.
I haven't heard of it.
Yeah, I made it an episode or two into Foundation and was like, I don't like this as much as I like the books. But what it sort of talks about is, Foundation talks about many, 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 many things. But the whole point of it is that somebody is creating a sort of an operating system or a series of information caches, social information caches that will allow society to be rebuilt after this catastrophe. And this is an intergalactic or interstellar civilization that is collapsing. And what I found most interesting and what sticks with me the most out of that series is the reason why that system was collapsing. And there's this throne world that's a world that's entirely covered by city, and it's just not working right, and it's got this cascading series of glitches, and things are just breaking down, and there's technicians who are working really, 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 really hard on trying to keep it going, but everybody knows that at a certain point entropy is just going to get out of hand, and everything's going to fall apart. And reading this in the 90s, I was like, well, that's ridiculous. Like, we know everything about, you know, how all our systems work. It's fine. Like, what have you? But I think AI, sort of a layer on top of everything else that we may not entirely understand. And as you think further into decades and centuries to come, the layers built on top of that we may understand less and less makes that disaster look a little more plausible.
So the idea is that we slowly don't understand because we're trusting the machines that much.
Exactly.
That's also the basis of Idiology.
Are you talking about Idiocracy?
Idiocracy, that's the
name.
Yes,
that is a classic. That is a classic.
They're getting slowly stupider and stupider, and they're spraying like Mountain Dew over the crops.
Yes,
and they're wondering
yes.
why it doesn't work.
Yeah, I watched that film for the first time only like 2 or 3 years ago, and it was pretty great. I'm blown away by that. But the thing about Idiocracy is that whichever Wilson brother it is comes out of his coma 200 years later, and he can just say like, "Hey, put water on the crops, man," and he's a genius, and things get better, and da da da.
It's also June. They don't use AI because it caused a bit of a kerfuffle. So if you ever watch June and wonder why everything's so analog, it's because they've went completely back.
Yes, the Butlerian Jihad, I think it's called. That they had, in the Dune universe, computers and artificial intelligence got out of hand. So they had a Butlerian Jihad that destroyed all of it. Sort of hyperlidism. Or what have you. But I had a disturbing conversation with a guy who knows the technology much better than I do a couple of weeks back. And he was like, already we're at the point where a lot of these researchers are sort of looking at these AI models and are going like, I don't know how it did that.
Because I think an important part of these machine learning is it's difficult or impossible to see how it's come up with the answer, which makes it very difficult to then tweak it. So they can also be tricked into thinking they're not the AI model they are.
Mm-hmm.
And then you don't know how it's done that.
Okay. I think they call it sort of emergent properties or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty solidly in the, these things are just programs. These things are hunks. These are parrots. They are not even a parrot. They have
they're an abacus.
Yeah, they have incredible.
We are driving the meaning from them.
Exactly. I'm very much in that camp, but that doesn't mean that it can't kill us.
Our humans will use it against us.
Well, humans will. It's more the and I think that's a very real possibility, and I think something a lot of folks are addressing. But why I want to bring Ronald Reagan into this, why I want to bring our sort of worldview into this.
Because he's your favorite man.
Because I love Ronald Reagan, obviously. I used to love him deeply, and I'm sort of falling out of love with him as time goes on. But the reason I want to bring our contemporary worldview into this so much is that I'm less concerned about the Skynet catastrophe or killer robots unleashed upon each other. I'm much more worried about the sort of foundation problem, which is like, we don't know how these systems work anymore, and they're layered on top of each other. And I'm much more concerned about nukes getting launched because of some weird bug that we don't understand, that I am some conscious decision by some bad actor or...
Well, I know currently they deliberately use very old technology to prevent that.
Sort of floppy disks and whatnot, like actual
yes,
floppy disks?
Yes, 1970s style computers, that sort of thing.
And with as many air gaps as possible. I'm 100%, I'm all in favor of that. All in favor of that. It's been much ballyhooed and clearly is already later than expected and may take decades more, but we are entering a world where computers control systems of vehicles. That's something that happens. Maybe I'm old enough that I'm not so much disappointed that we don't have full self-driving cars yet as I am amazed by the capacities of the vehicles we have. It's just like it's like a, I think it's a 10-year-old car, but it's newer than the ones I typically borrow from my parents. And I, put it on cruise control, and if a car pulls in front of me, it slows down automatically. Like, that just seems like magic to me. I don't know. I think we're going to, even if AI disappoints spectacularly, and that's usually my default, I expect things to disappoint spectacularly. Even if it's just going to continue adding layers of capability and possibility to our lives. I just think about how it's worked its way into my workflow, specifically with Adobe products. I now do text-based editing. For the last two videos that I've done, I have spent for 8 years, I've, you know, laboriously clicked manually. You know, you have this timeline when you're editing video, and I've just sort of gone in and listened to it and clicked, oh no, I breathed there, that wasn't good, and sort of cut back, and it's taken this incredibly long period of time. Now Adobe offers text-based editing. I just upload, I don't have to, I just download my clip. Most of the English it does perfectly, reproduces what I've said, and I can cut and paste things in that block of text, and it is reproduced in a video. It just makes things so much faster. I think I talked last episode about, and I also process the audio, so it's much, much cleaner instantly than anything I could have done with hours of work beforehand.
And also, one area where it will be very good is I'm dyslexic, so I was writing the descriptions for the podcast, and then I started using ChatGPT, and then Rob says, out of the blue, oh, you're doing a great job with the descriptions. And I was like, oh, I have to be honest, I've been using ChatGPT. So I think we're using it very light. There's people that are flat out. Yeah. It's like every aspect is AI.
Yeah. It's interesting. And I've noticed recently I used to have to change the ChatGPT a lot. But the past two, those Erdogan podcasts.
Mm-hmm. I think the big thing is it's almost like turning everyone into an editor. Mm-hmm. Like every time I'm going through it and trimming it, and so it's never 100%. Mm-hmm. It always assumes certain things. We have certain experts on, and I'm like, sadly, we don't. So I think that's the main thing. Is you're going to be, it's basically, don't let it just run on autopilot. You've always got to be keeping checks, because AI has a strange thing of doing literally what you say. Mm. If you ever see machine learning, and it's something very simple in a 2D plane, and you want it to essentially learn, evolve walking. Mm-hmm. So you let it be able to walk in whatever way it wants, and then grow its legs and move its legs whatever way it wants. What it might do sometimes is make like a stool and then like a spring. Mm-hmm. So theoretically, it's walked to the destination you wanted, but you wanted it to walk like a person, not like a weird spring lander. Mm-hmm. So when you think that it will literally do what you want, but it doesn't understand anything, and it'll give you what you want, is the main issue.
Yeah, it doesn't understand anything, and we're mm-hmm. beginning to lose understanding of what
and
it's doing.
And if you
doing.
Just let it go on autopilot. I think there's the paperclip thought experiment where you tell the AI, I want you to make loads of paperclips, so it tries to make the factory more and more efficient, and then mm-hmm. It then worries that, oh, humans are going to tell me to stop making paperclips. Mm-hmm. So it kills all humans so it can go around the world or the universe making paperclips.
So that's an AI, not a theory of AI as like a super intelligence, but a...
It's almost like it's so intelligent and stupid and powerful.
Yeah, that's more the AI that I believe in. Just this, it's a
tool.
So
it's not malicious. It's not like, you know, this is for the betterment of the universe. It's just you've told it to make paperclips, and now you've given it too much power.
Yeah, it's just a tool that we've lost control,
misused,
lost understanding of. And I think that the more that we approach these things as if from the get-go, as if we have no control over them, with this sort of Reagan, we can't control anything ideology, like the more likely it is we'll lose complete control before too long.
Because I kind of believe this open letter a lot of tech people have written is purely so they can catch up. There's I think Elon Musk is one of the most famous, and is it Wozniak from Apple have said, oh, no AI beyond ChatGPT-4 should be developed for the next 6 months. And I think that's a strange time frame when a lot of you people are making your own AIs that aren't as good.
And I also don't really think the idea that we could change anything seriously systemic over the next 6 months that would make things different
big
after
difference.
This pause is very hard to credit. I don't think there's enough focus on the institutions behind AI. You know, some of them, the pretty unattractive and public tech billionaires, but it's also just like plenty of inoffensive and hardworking and nice tech billionaires that we should also be just a little concerned about. You know, it just the OpenAI. I spent maybe 5 minutes reading the Wikipedia on OpenAI's development, and it's fascinating because OpenAI started out as a nonprofit, I believe, and it may, mm-hmm. there may be still some aspects of it that are.
Yeah, an open source nature originally.
Yeah, but it's specifically what's called OpenAI. Yeah, specifically geared towards, or at least this is how they talked 8 years ago, the true Skynet superhuman version of, is it AGI they call it, like advanced general intelligence, general intelligence or whatever.
I think general intelligence is the idea that it's as smart as a human.
Or vastly, and then quickly become vastly smarter.
Oh yeah, then from
smarter.
There it yeah, could get right. Yeah, more intelligent. Yeah.
Artificial general intelligence, but their idea back in say 2015, 2016 when they got started is like, oh, well we're gonna take this nonprofit structure and we're gonna make sure that the first AGI, you know, we're going to be out ahead and our mission is to make sure that it's benign and it's good and it's not a problem. That's our mission. And then 3 or 4 years later, I think the only like real reporting I've seen on this is about the falling out that Elon Musk had with OpenAI. Like he was on the board and then he left the board and whatever. But also like the nature of the company changed very significantly. And I think this is a classic example of our just sort of Reaganite business fundamentalism
classic tech bro, which is steal open source software and then manage to sell it.
You find a way to privatize and profit off of it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so they got a lot of people invested in this nonprofit positive ideology. They built stuff out, and then 2 or 3 years ago, they're like, you know what?
Let's just make cash.
To get the best researchers, you got to understand we've just got to give people an ownership stake and we've just got to, you know, be a business. And that's just the only way to get anything done, guys. So now OpenAI is a, I'm sure there's still vestigial nonprofit elements, but fundamentally it's a business. And it's a business that is racing to be first. Above all else, hell for leather, and you know these positive aspirations from its founding 5-6 years ago, and of course it's those positive aspirations for its founding, you know, were able to garner a lot of money and were able to garner a lot of goodwill from a lot of high powered researchers who may have helped them to get as far ahead as they are in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's just, you know, I get irritated hearing myself talk about this sort of thing because I remember being irritated by these arguments and finding them just annoyingly left-wing as recently as 5-10 years ago. But it's just such obvious privatization of public effort, you know, for private gain. And it's infuriating. And these are the people who aren't as gross as the, you know, tech bro venture capitalists on podcasts or anything. But these are the folks who are creating this technology that's supposed to be so world-changing, and they are the folks who started a nominally nonprofit business, took a bunch of money and expertise, and then turned it into a business for their benefit. And like this is our Pope of AI or what have you. You know, this is not great. And to be clear, you know, it's not just OpenAI. OpenAI is simply the most famous of these.
The most successful.
Yeah. That we know of. I mean, they're the ones. I mean, OpenAI was a nonprofit that was a private-ish company, though I think they were already relying on a lot of Microsoft money. And now they, because of their public relations success, they are now much more deeply affiliated to the tune of $10 billion with Microsoft.
Helping Bing become incredibly popular out of nowhere.
Yeah. and I think I saw something saying that the Bing started doing really well and then has now fallen off again. Because Google's rolling out its own version. Google's got its version. Amazon, I think, has some stuff. I know Facebook has some stuff. Facebook is apparently pivoted away from that absolutely disastrous Meta.
Yes. It's hard to know what Meta is. Like, I'm into VR and stuff, and I still don't know what's going on there.
Oh, have you ever played around with the Facebook Meta stuff?
Well, because my headsets wouldn't support it, because I think, weirdly, what made them popular is you could kind of access Facebook in anything, and then for Meta, it seems like they're very restrictive, like you have to use our hardware.
Well, that sounds irritating.
Yeah, but they've essentially just made a game, like, what is it, VR Chat? It's essentially that, but with a lot more restrictions on it.
So they attempted to... they attempted to create a walled garden before actually creating a garden that anybody wanted to come to?
I don't know what they're doing, because there's a game called Rec Room, which is like, it's got a team of like 20 people, and I don't know what Metaverse has spent all these billions on. It just looks horrendous.
Yeah, I think
But yeah, AI is the next buzzword, so pile all your money in there.
I think that Mark Zuckerberg has realized that if he keeps pushing any further on Meta, he, even with his incredibly protected position, he may find himself out of a job.
They may trap him in Meta.
So, yeah. Oh, that hadn't thought of that.
Keep him in the metaverse where he can't do any harm.
Well, I was thinking the corporate structure. You know, it's like, oh, sure, of course, you're a big owner of Meta. We're going to run off with all the companies that actually make money. But, yeah, I think he's realized now he has to talk about AI constantly. So yeah, and it just that the idea that these companies can just sort of own and use our data to do stuff is something that I used to be perfectly comfortable with in my more sort of libertarian youth,
until people could generate your books.
yes, that I'm not so happy about, but it's I'm beginning to realize that actually those data privacy people were going on about somewhat useful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's fascinating just watching how clarifying this is, because it has put us into a new world when it comes to the internet, when it comes to data privacy, when it comes to intellectual property more generally. I was reading, to prepare for this, I was reading a recent Economist report on AI and regulation, and I was very surprised to read that and to find The Economist, which is a pretty strongly
pro-business,
deep lover of Ronald Reagan and Reaganite ideology. I was actually very surprised to see it saying very begrudgingly, well, actually, Europe's probably got the best set of regulatory approaches.
Well, I think what's interesting with this is it's a lot of businesses are now going to tear each other apart, because you have the likes of, was it Getty Images, the stock image, like, you know, giant superpower, are now getting very annoyed that these image generators are basically using their images to then recreate other stuff. So theoretically, you wouldn't need stock images. You'd just say, get me a stock images of Rob Morris. I need them for his new book. So we don't need a photographer. We don't need stock images. So they're, you know, armoring their lawyers saying... I think the argument the AI is saying, we're not storing the data. It's almost like the AI just found it on the internet. We're not keeping it in our servers, so it's perfectly legal. So there will be a big, you know, business battle.
Yeah. Well, I think, I don't know if it was Midjourney or some other service that was generating these images, and you could actually see the ghostly outline of the Getty
Images. I think that might have been
watermark.
ChatGPT. It has DALL-E is its image generator.
Ah, yes.
And some of its very early stuff is quite bad and sort of dreamlike. But yeah, it would have like a weird, like, photocopied, unreadable watermark right in the middle. And I was like, oh, I wonder where you got these from.
it's quite something. I was wondering, actually, if Getty and other image repositories are successful, I was kind of wondering, do we just sort of get like steampunk image generation by default? Like,
well, what's public domain? Will it be the 70s? Will it be the 60s?
Well, I think it varies by jurisdiction. So
patents, you know, for inventions is 25 years normally. And then I don't know. I know obviously Disney recreates stuff so they can keep the copyright for, you know, things that kind of were public domain.
Well, it's kind of fascinating. So are we just going to have image generation based on like old masters? And as everything is the public domain, all of a sudden going to start being...
Well, I've heard it's going to be very good for...
Renaissance cherubs.
Literature majors, because if you say, write this in some obscure writer that no one knows about, you're like, oh, write this modern thing in that style. You could do great. But yeah. It's all about pruning. You can't just say, write my book. It's all about you figuring out the AI and working out the best way to use it.
Fascinating.
Have you got any current things that are happening that are scaring you with AI? So not your, you know, Terminators. What's happening right now?
Well, the insane job destruction for creative types. I had decided, I really need to... I've tried to record books on tape for myself three or four times. Books on tape. Audiobooks. That's what they call it.
Showing your age.
Yes, yes. I've tried to record... Oh, dear me. I've tried to record audiobooks for myself.
Cylinder.
Numerous times on wax cylinders, obviously. And they just keep melting, and it's a problem. Now, I've tried to record them multiple times, and it's never good enough for the ACX. Yeah, for the Audible thing. And I just committed myself, you know what? For the next book, I'm just going to pay the $5,000 and go get this recorded. I'm going to go record it myself, but I'm going to record it, you know, officially. You know, I'm going to pay $5,000. Not now that we have this Adobe podcast thing.
Mm-hmm.
I will, you know, take the steps that I took before, record on a nice microphone in a controlled environment, and then run it through this Adobe tool, and I assume I'll have no trouble at all.
Well, the other thing would be is the voice generations are getting that good that you could give it hours of you talking and then go, now say all these words.
I tried to do that recently. I didn't try to do that. I spent half an hour researching how to do that. and it seems like the snippets are smaller. Mm-hmm. The ones that are commercially available anyway are smaller than you'd like or need. But I would love it.
But it's definitely going in that direction.
Yeah, I think this time next year, I'll probably be able to film a script, write a script, and then say, you know what, I'm just going to do stock footage this time. I'm not going to have myself talking. And then press a button and have it ready to go, and I just drop in the stock footage, and that sounds pretty great. Of course, my concern, though, is I'd have to go over with a fine-tooth comb. A lot of these are sort of smaller companies. I'm going to assume that if, you know, Adobe offered something like that, they wouldn't be like, and now we own your voice. But if it's some, like, strange...
It's hard to know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who reads the terms and conditions?
Weird thing with intellectual property where it's sort of like, I actually want stronger protections for intellectual property now in some cases, but like, would that make it easier for somebody to decide they have rights to my voice?
Mm-hmm.
So these things have to be carefully crafted.
And also how close, like, let's say I want to use your voice and you're like, nope, it's copyrighted. How much can I change it? And it's like technically not your voice.
Yep.
And then just do that instead. Which is, I think, the musicians will be at the front of that legal case.
Yeah, it's quite something. The Economist favorably, I mean, perhaps for the first time in the history of the publication, favorably contrasted the European regulatory approach to AI to the...
Because I think Italy's banned ChatGPT, has it?
Who banned ChatGPT?
Italy.
Really? I didn't know that. Wow.
Got spooked.
but I think Europe came out with a broad-based, very quickly came out with a pretty broad-based, detailed description of what the regulatory framework was and differing approaches for differing types of technology and just really like dove into the nitty-gritty. And I think the general perspective of like The Economist where someone else would be like, well, come on, if you get that detailed, and this is a longstanding critique of the EU, it's like, oh, it's so detailed, it stifles innovation or one of that. The Economist in this context was like, maybe there's details, there's definitely details we do differently, but this is moving fast enough that this is the right way to, this is the right approach.
But it's and also the elephant in the room is journalism. It's
sure.
Well, it's apparently been AI for a long time for, you know, like dog racing and stuff. stuff no journalist wants to do. That's generally just this dog came first, this one came second, and it's basic stuff like that. But it's also the fact, you know, I've been using it for the descriptions. How many journalists are letting ChatGPT do a lot of work and taking all the credit? And then what if some, you know, young, hot, new newspaper comes up and it's just like, yeah, the vast majority is just AI and people love it and we're making money.
Well, I thought about that. Yeah, so what if you could nominally put out like a newsletter where it's like, hey, you know, I want to cover all these countries and just, you know, ask ChatGPT when it thinks and just change it subtly.
But then it's almost like, in that sense, you're an editor.
Yep.
You're almost, it's almost like ChatGPT's lots of the staff and you have your correspondents all over the world. And then all you do is spend your day is editing it. So it feels like you've just changed your roles. It depends how, you know, strict you are. I'm sure some people will just be like, as many words as possible, get them out.
Well, every writer is an editor to some extent. That's a good point. I think that a lot of folks are just, I think Amazon's having a real problem with the Kindle books. They make it very straightforward. If you want to publish a book, I've done it multiple times. But now people are just like, yeah, I'm just using ChatGPT to generate a whole mess of text and maybe reading it, maybe not, and seeing if someone will buy it.
Because I've heard a story of someone getting a children's book published. You know, everything was AI and they just went through it. So yeah, now if you want to make money on AI, I think now's the time before everyone's at it. Fill your boots.
Just back to that European regulatory approach, I think that's sort of an interesting contrast between the US and UK perspective, and The Economist makes this contrast, where they're like, we'll figure it out. Things will, you know, we've got a lot of current laws. Let's see what shakes out. And I think that it's a sign of how spooked smart people are that The Economist is like, actually, no, let's not go with the hyper-innovation thing. And I think that's, it's also really kind of fascinating, that letter you mentioned earlier, like this sort of industry letter Elon Musk signed on. Hey, let's all agree to step back and pause. Whereas in EU, they're like, no, here's a set of regulations, and this stuff you can and work on in certain ways, this stuff you cannot, this stuff you have to submit for approval before it goes to the, whatever it exactly it is. And it's just an example of sort of Reaganite brain damage, that instead, you know, all the hyper-libertarians of Silicon Valley, instead of being like, yeah, I guess we need, like, here's this basic set of regulations we really need, and obviously we have the technical know-how to do a better job of helping you craft these regulations than Europe does, which the U.S. could totally do. Instead, they're like, oh, no, we're just going to, like, voluntarily decide to, with, you know, it's like...
Although the only one that, like, they're worried about hasn't signed it, so it's meaningless.
Yeah. But it's just like, you know, and it was going to be meaningless anyway. Like, it's not like some voluntary, like, restraint. It's, you just need government. Like, there is a common entity that can handle these things. And I'm not saying that the EU regulation is flawless. In fact, I'm sure it's not. But
it's at least something.
Exactly. And this, it's really fast. I don't know if I've talked about this before, and it's in a different capacity, but it also just sort of talks to the current bankruptcy of Reaganism, more broadly. There was this, it was a TikTok, I can't believe it, but it was a TikTok of Charlie Munger, who is Warren Buffett's number two guy, or investing partner, you know, Warren Buffett, the sage of Omaha, the, you know, one of the richest men in the world or whatnot. And he was talking about something that I had been very optimistic about. Healthcare in the United States is famously a nightmare.
Bureaucratic nightmare?
It's a bureaucratic nightmare. It's a capitalistic nightmare. It's just for the sake of humanity. It's a nightmare. It's terrible. It's a real, real bad thing. And he was talking about, this is something that happened about 5 years ago. I believe it was JP Morgan, Amazon, and Warren Buffett got together and were like, hey, we, so Warren Buffett's business would be Berkshire Hathaway, and these three just absolute capitalist titans, some of the biggest companies in the United States, biggest companies in the world, got together and were like, hey, we are going to solve this healthcare thing.
Oh, that's nice of them.
In the U.S., like, healthcare is mostly employer-based, which adds all manner of...
Yeah, so you're trapped in with your job.
Yeah. But they're like, no, we're going to form this big network with the hundreds of thousands of employees we have, and we're going to do healthcare better, and then we're going to figure out how we're going to do healthcare so much better, and then we're going to expand it to the whole country, and we're just, you know, we're gonna make monopoly virtuous. I mean, that wasn't what they explicitly said, but that was the implication. And I was honestly pretty excited about this. I was like, yeah, finally. Like, yeah, I bet once you put these business masters behind us, everything will be great. And this Charlie Munger clip was over the past 6 months or so. And he was just like, yeah, Warren and his buddies tried to do that. And it was a complete failure. Like, because it's just this, like...
Was it only theoretical, or did they have like one hospital and try it out, or?
I think they had some clinics or just figured out different ways to pay for things or negotiated whatever. And he was like, yeah, like Warren, this businessman of businessmen was just completely defeated by it. You need government. Like, there's just this whole...
Well, Singapore had a similar thing. They kind of let it completely laissez-faire, and then they went, oh, this just focuses on really niche medicine for incredibly rich people. Yeah. So they now have a kind of, you know, government company balance.
Yeah. And again, I am not against laissez-faire in principle. I think there are periods of time and there are industries in the United States today that need more laissez-faire, that need more free market approaches. But in general, this cult of the free market that I'm calling Reaganism for shorthand, is a real problem, it should not be allowed to be as omnipresent and determinative as it is, because I think it's a real challenge.
Do you want to hear some spooky AI?
Sure.
Researchers use an MRI machine to read people's brainwaves.
Wow.
Do you know what's the scariest part?
What?
They were using ChatGPT-1.
Oh, wow. Okay. So we're now up to, is it 4 is the one
4.
That's got everybody 4
in a tizzy? 4 is the one that's got everyone in a fluster.
Yeah.
I think it was very difficult to use up until recently. So now, you know, if you don't know it, I think you have to, you know, log in to some extent. So the one that is on Bing, it's got more checks and balances, and it's designed to help you, you know, search the internet while, you know, ChatGPT 4 proper is kind of very conversational and a lot more easy to access. So it's hard to believe that this GPT or ChatGPT 1, because the research has only come out about it because, you know, to peer review something takes a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But it felt like, from what I understood, it would have someone read or reread a sentence, you know, read the brainwaves and spit back. It wasn't quite right, but it would get the gist, which is scary.
It's AI is reading our minds.
And it's difficult for it to go from one person's brain to another. It seems to be, you know, brains are very unique. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe were saying that, you know, it's unlikely that this could be used, you know, against someone's will. But if a state has the access to this, they could easily drug someone, put them in it, and then run through the alphabet, you know, test things to calibrate it to your brain. This is what I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, basically read your mind. So that's a worrying scenario.
Or an exciting scenario.
Oh, definitely. It'll be great for locked-in syndrome. Well, there is a whole realm of things that it would be brilliant for and terrifying for.
Well, there's a whole realm of work and life that isn't really necessarily that much fun, that we don't, like, need to do. And, you know, it's not like human happiness or flourishing will diminish at all. If we spend less time in meetings or sending pointless emails to each other,
that
and the other thing. It's actually only the sort of Reaganite orthodoxy we live with that makes this as scary as it is. Like the a lot of what people do in offices day to day.
Oh yeah, it's miserable.
It's not ennobling, it's not useful or in any way. The reason that the prospect of that work disappearing is so terrifying is because in the United States specifically, but I think in the world more generally, we've got so much of one's ability to feed oneself wrapped up in your ability to be a cog in a not particularly interesting machine, corporate machine.
Well, I think the jobs that are in the major trouble, so ChatGPT, think of it as like a database you can chat to or talk to. So try not to think of it as human, because people naturally want to. Like you could just draw a face on a piece of paper and people instantly now think it's got life to it. So, you know, all the records and all the forms. So if your job is summarizing records and forms for a corporation, there's a good chance your job prospects in the next decade are not good. And also, have you heard about what Wendy's is up to?
What's Wendy's up to?
Wendy's is a fast food chain in America.
Well, yes, now that you've mentioned it, I'm going to have to go eat it, but yes.
Other ones are up to it too. Other fast food places I haven't heard of. So when you go to the drive-thru and tell it what your order, they're planning on doing a trial where ChatGPT will be hearing your order and giving that out. So that could be potentially less staff needed in burger chains.
But the thing is, like, who actually, like, wants to be working as staff in a burger chain? Who actually wants to be collating record for Universal Corp?
You know, some people need money and need a job, and it's also a place where people, you know, get generally start their first job.
Well, no, I agree, but then, like, maybe this goes beyond my, like, let's go back to the FDR era, and maybe this does get a little communist, but like, why? You know, I think that like we've had like a series, a lot of people who questioned why has productivity, I don't understand
stagnated.
The math. Yeah, productivity is stagnated. I don't really understand the math or the assumptions behind productivity calculations, but I've tried a couple times. But why is productivity stagnated? Why has all this incredible innovation with technology done so little for us over the past 30, 40 years? And that's because I think that some of these technologies, and AI in particular, lend themselves to, you know, to truly unleash the potential of these technologies. You need some serious societal shifts. You need some serious, like, there really is, like, how is it so terrifying that the idea that people could spend more time, you know, doing art, how is that so scary? And that's because of the priorities of the society we've set up. And I think that this would have been a much less scary prospect as recently as the 1950s, 1960s in the United States, and like the level of community and social protection we had back then. I'm not saying it wouldn't have been a problem, but like, it would have been a much less intimidating problem. But we've just gotten to this point where you're either a plutocrat or your job is your whole life and you must be working so that you can consume. And if you can't work, you will not consume. Like, it's...
Do you think universal basic income is a way of helping AI?
I mean, something like it. Well, I think the best arguments I've read against universal basic income come down to, oh, that's just physically impossible. The math doesn't pencil out. And then, I don't know, and then after COVID and really just the past 15 years of watching the basic math at the Fed not pencil out at all, you know, and it's just like, well, I don't know.
Well, a lot of countries do give people money that are unemployed, so you could see it as like a stronger version of that.
Yeah. Well, I think we basically, I've referred to it in the past, but we basically had universal basic income in the United States during COVID. The super unemployment benefits, which were, you know, dramatically, I think in most cases doubled, if not more. In the United States, unemployment benefit is provided primarily at the state level, I believe. But then the federal government stepped in to like essentially double that money. And that was a kind of universal basic income. And I think I need to read more on this, but my understanding is that it was really good for the economy.
Well, the thing is, though, the less money you have, the more money percentage you spend, because you have to survive. There's certain things you have to pay for to live. So if you're poor and you get money, it's being spent back into the economy, while the richer that you are, the more you save.
You just go pile it in on some private island somewhere.
Yeah.
I think that another way of looking at Reaganism, another way of looking at the past 40 years, is that it was about giving money to rich people.
Well, you could say you're stealing money from the state because everyone's paid for a certain, public good, and then you're just going, here you go, private, you can have it for next to nothing, and then make a large profit.
Yeah. And I think that, again, that in the 1980s, maybe, we did need to do some of that, and that did create some business or what have you, but it hasn't for the past 20 years or so. And if you just give money, choose, and as we did, I think, to an extent during COVID, choose for the first time in like 40, 50 years to give a new benefit or give some money to poor people, that money gets, it gets zoomed right back into the economy. Yeah. And I think that's got a lot to do with, we're in this point, we may be at the end of it, but for the past 3 years in the United States, we've been in this place like, we don't understand why this economy is so good. I don't get it. We've raised the rates. We've then done this. The supply chains are screwed. But it's just this rampagingly happy economy. And shockingly few people want to just be like, we gave money to poor people.
Normal people.
Maybe, the normal people. We gave money to normal people who could use it and did use it. Mm-hmm. And that created a sort of velocity of transactions that has kept, given us the most impressive economic growth since the 1960s.
Funny that.
It's like, weird, huh? That's another one of the things that really, really finally killed Reaganism for me was looking at economic growth statistics and just realizing, oh, wow, you just look at economic growth statistics from like 1960 on, or certainly from like 1940 on, and you're like, wow, that old statist FDR, quasi-socialist place was economically vastly more successful than the Reagan era has been. Like, GDP grew a lot more. I think in the 80s, like, the 80s were better than the 70s, and the 90s were like about, were better than the 70s. But the 2000s and the 2010s have been dramatically worse than any FDR decade in terms of economic growth in the developed world.
The other sad thing is a lot of economic models sort of demand a certain amount of unemployment. But it's basically saying this is a vital thing for the economy, so anyone that is in that situation, we're going to punish.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you just sort of, because that's the only cure for inflation is firing people. And of course, to give those people money.
Well, I think it's also there's a worry that if you have full employment, the economy's too hot.
Yeah, yeah, that is a concern as well. And it's frustrating sitting here in 2023 and sort of looking at changes to energy technologies, changes to computing technologies, and being like, God damn, we're just on the cusp of Star Trek here, aren't we? Like, we're like really just.
Well, here's a very dystopian thing. Could you see, say, like a Waco style thing? Say there's some community in America, mm-hmm. and the AI, they're very pro AI, they're mm-hmm. self-sufficient, and they're almost just like, just leave us alone. Could you mm-hmm. see the government being pushed by big corporations to put a pin in that?
I mean, at this point, no, because I think our approach to AI is do whatever you want.
Okay.
Yeah. But the thing is, like, I really do think, like, we're on the cusp of
something great.
Yeah, like, and I kind of feel like the main thing holding us back at this point is
20th century ideology.
Yeah, a set of ideologies that I just that I used to really subscribe to, but just don't seem to make a lot of sense. Like, we're very much in a post scarcity era at this point. And it's just a question of divvying up things a little bit more, differing approaches to a few things, like a few details. And we're living in utopia. And it's very frustrating to see each new set of technologies, instead of being used to do that, being used to create. Like, I don't think in 1990. When we were all getting excited about the World Wide Web, we were like, yeah, we're going to make a new era of robber barons. That's what we're excited about. We're going to make some new Carnegies and Rockefellers. That's the goal. I don't think that was what anybody had in mind, but that's certainly what we did. And I feel like we can do better, like as a species.
our jobs where we just try to search engine optimize everything and make articles that are borderline gibberish just because it ticks Google's boxes.
Yeah, that's not that is another not great thing about the internet. So yeah, it's just there's so much potential, and it just
well, the personalized tutoring it seems like a very interesting thing.
Yes, I'm a big fan of that. Mm-hmm. You've been reading about it, reading up on it as well?
Well, I've heard about some tutors or some university, basically. The guy's like, you can use ChatGPT all you want. I just want the text to be accurate and consistent and mm-hmm. tell me what prompts you used.
Interesting.
That is so interesting. So there does seem to be, there are places that are embracing it. I'm sure it's still like a tenth of a percent at this point, but it's could just completely revolutionize learning. And also, as I say, with me being dyslexic, theoretically I could start writing a book because I can get things read back to me, and then quite often for emails I've just thrown it in, it says make the grammar good and it just like for simple stuff like that, keep everything the same but just make it good grammar in English and it's like there you go.
There you go. Well, you're familiar with the writer Neal Stephenson?
No.
So he's most well known for a book called Snow Crash, which just sort of was like one of the first like cyberpunk novels, the visualization of the internet, actually a lot of virtual reality stuff, just really, really defining book of the 1980s. But his follow-up book, I wonder in some ways, might be more defining. It's called The Diamond Age, and it's about this sort of neo-steampunk era that's very hyper-capitalist and grim or what have you. But this waif, this sort of underprivileged orphan finds this illustrated primer or something along those lines, which is essentially an AI tutor. And the I can't even remember what the action of the book was from there. I just remember enjoying it very much. And it's, yeah, it's we really could... The potential, one of the potential applications of artificial intelligence is that essentially everybody can have the private educational experience of a 19th century European aristocrat. There was an interesting article I read a couple months back talking about how, you know, with all of this information, the internet, the technological advancement, why don't we have as many geniuses as we used to? And it's because even at the highest levels, with the exception of like Oxford, Cambridge or whatnot, most people, even at the highest levels, are sitting in a classroom being kind of bored, where actually it's one-on-one tutoring that is how most geniuses were made. Even those who weren't lucky enough to be in the aristocracy back in the 19th century.
Well, I think Beethoven's a great example because weren't both his parents music teachers?
Oh, well, there you go. There you go. And yeah, so it's like the potential of these technologies is limitless. And I think it's a lack of imagination, the level of sort of societal organization that makes them terrifying, really. Makes them more terrifying than they should be.
So you're hoping they'll take a lot of drudgery out of jobs?
I'm hoping, yeah.
Because I this is not quite AI, but, some of the robots that worked at the Amazon warehouse, they lift like a little shelf. It looks like a wee Roomba, but it just like expands up slightly and it lifts a shelf and then drives it to where it needs to go. And I remember thinking, you know, here's jobs being taken away. But I don't know whether this was propaganda on Amazon behalf, but one of the comments is basically like, it's doing the most horrible, repetitive job that everyone hated doing. And we're so glad they're taking that away from us.
Uh-huh.
But the main one will be in dangerous situations. The bots being teamed up with the robots, being able to do work in steel mills, nuclear power plants, all that. When you see what Boston Dynamics is up to with proper AI, well, machine learning, there's definitely going to be some incredible benefits for working people and less bad backs, hopefully.
Well, I want to know when Boston Dynamics is going to start working on the city-sized mechs, right? Isn't that supposed to happen?
Oh my goodness!
Big old robots that can battle in the. Did you ever see Pacific Rim? You know, or
It's just the years I guess I was thinking too small scale.
Yeah, we just need all wars to, you know, be on the level of, you know, anime, 1980s anime, you know? They can just battle it out in space somewhere and we can...
Oh my goodness. Well, speaking of using AI for military, have you heard of Palantir?
Palantir has, you know, it's funny. I don't know enough about that company to feel as negatively towards it as I do.
It was very secretive until very recently.
But it's just big data solutions.
It seems to be AI plus drones, but it's the fact you can just chat to it like a human. Mm-hmm. It would be like, how many baddies are on the front line? What sort of weaponry do they have? Please engage them with drone 4, please.
Yeah,
it's so weird and both so human-esque, but then mm-hmm. so detached. So, and you know, if that's that's the only one we know about.
Oh, God, I didn't realize.
And also, you've been talking about the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
What are they up to? Because we know the Russians don't have much.
I mean, the Chinese tech companies are trying to do versions of what the U.S. tech companies are doing. The usage of the Chinese state of these technologies is...
Well, I think the face recognition's a big one that's using this AI. Well, not ChatGPT. They're using their own machine learning to work out faces.
I mean, well, we will certainly see.
It sounds like you're going to commit some crimes in China just to test it out.
Yeah, just to sort of give it a whirl. See what you want to have a More Freedom Foundation trip to China, and we'll just do some vandalism.
I'd prefer not to.
Yeah, I feel like that'd probably be a poor choice. Yeah,
but maybe a More Freedom Foundation live podcast at some stage if things go well.
We'll do some live vandalism in China. That seems,
it away from vandalism.
Yeah, I think that'd be a weird choice.
If the AIs let us.
Yeah, indeed. Yes. So it's a fascinating area of human achievement that is just wrapped up in so much fear and mess. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like our societal organization hasn't really caught up to our digital technologies.
But it does just feel like we're about to fully go into what we would perceive the future.
Oh, man, we've been there for a while. I'm still...
Oh, I know, but it almost felt like everything was just like getting the seeds planted. You know, the 1920s doesn't quite feel like the 20th century, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. No, I think we were talking about, was it on this... episode of the episode before, we're talking about sort of periodization and you know, sort of before AI and after AI. It's interesting how just quickly the conversation has changed. Like, I consider myself a big AI critic mm-hmm. because I'm like, oh, come on, like the singularity, this, you know, we're gonna get Skynet, that's ridiculous. But like 2 years ago, it was like, AI, whatever, you know, like it was sub-meta, you know, it was like, sure, whatever, that means nothing. But now it's like, as a skeptic, I'm still saying, oh, this is in the process of changing everything, and will continue to change everything at, if not an accelerating pace, a more or less constant pace for all the years to come. And that is quite something to contemplate, even without the horror scenarios.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.